Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour, November 9th, 2017. Tonight's main science topic, I will be talking about comets again. Last week, I talked about comets becoming planets, and now it's official. I held off on making more announcements about this big comet that had been discovered actually officially last May, but more officially in 2013. And so NASA has been sitting on this. So they're saying it was discovered between Saturn and Uranus, but it was discovered 4 years ago. So it was farther out in the solar system, and they did not say anything. And so pretty soon, it would be potentially discovered by amateurs. So they had to blow the lid off of this so they could control the narrative. If amateurs had discovered it, say, for example, myself, then the question would arise with NASA and its search automated search engines, programs, telescopes, to why had they not discovered this? And then, of course, it comes out that they did. So they had to control the narrative on this, and that's what I'll be talking about tonight, but also pointing out some of the idiosyncrasies of this, and this will by far exceed Hale-Bopp in all of the records in size, in duration in the solar system. It will not be in the inner solar system until 2022. So that's like, what, 6 years away. Hale-Bopp was visible to the naked eye for a period of 6 years. This comet will shatter that record, which by far beat any other comet in history, except maybe the Christmas star, which was visible for many, many years. Remember that the Magi followed the Christmas star, which was a very unusual object in the sky. They discovered it in the east, but followed it to the west. Remember that. And they found it, of course, it came to rest. Now, that's an astrological term also. It came to rest on the place where they found the baby Jesus. So, anyway, that's just a little historical record. And by the way, we're coming up to Christmas. So, you know, fasten your seatbelts, get your hip boots on. They're going to come out with the constant drum of planetary alignments was the Christmas star. And I've said many times before, this is, as with everything that comes out of the standard scientific community, the Christmas star, they're going to say, was a planetary alignment, and it was not. It was not a planetary alignment. It couldn't have been by when you look at all of the historical record, it was an object up in the sky and it lasted for years. Planetary alignments last for maybe a night or two at most. And all it is, it's not a physical alignment, it's an optical, it's a visual alignment, meaning that because of the position of planets in their orbits, they become visually aligned, not physically aligned. And there's no electrical connection, there's no gravitational issues, which there aren't anyway, because we're gravitationless with respect to all of the other planets. But it's just a visual effect, and it only lasts, in a sense, a number of hours. And then the planets and the Earth moves, and the alignment, the visual alignment, goes away. So it's something that's very brief, and it's something that it happens all the time. We get planetary visual alignments sometimes 2-3 times a year with various planets, or the moon goes by Venus or something. You know, and they make a big write-up about it, like you go out and look in the sky, and it's interesting to see. But it certainly was not the Christmas star by any stretch of the imagination. And so the Christmas star was clearly a comet, but not any comet. It was a comet that these people had been waiting for literally thousands of years. And in the inner circles, it was known what characteristics this comet would have. And I suspected that it was a comet that probably had two companions. In other words, two little comets surrounding one big comet, something so unusual that when you saw it, you immediately knew that that was it. And so the higher level people back then in society were looking for this, and the three magi, the kings, were astrologers. They had teams of astrologers working for them, and they studied the night sky. And so totally independently, without ever communicating, they didn't have cell phones, they didn't have telephones, they didn't have satellite communications. They were in different countries. But all, when this showed up, they all recognized it immediately. And so the Christmas star was clearly a comet, and it has comet-type characteristics. It was discovered in the east. And then they packed their bags, which took a while, and camel trains, we know that they came in from the east, so they were riding on a camel train, which is the characteristic Christmas scene, which is true. And they met, of course, their paths were converging as they went westward seeking the nativity scene, the Messiah, that was what the comet symbol meant. And they met and they traveled together. And by the time they got to Herod, they stopped for a night, and he wanted to know all about it, like he just didn't know. Well, of course he knew, but he wanted to get information on from them as to where they were going. And so they realized that they didn't trust this guy. Well, I wouldn't have either. This Herod guy was a pretty shady guy, as it turns out. And so anyway, they left under cover of darkness and did not return. And Herod went out and had all the firstborn killed in the country. Remember, and this is, you know, this is history. These are historical facts. So the point is that the Christmas star was not, it could not have been by any stretch of the imagination, a planetary alignment. Could not have been. Because it, you know, it had to cover the span of all of this activity going on over the course of years. It's not like the three kings jumped in their Mercedes-Benz and drove across the desert in an afternoon. No. They had to pack. They had to get all their stuff together. They had to get their kingdom in order. They had to travel, which was slow, you know, possibly covering 10 miles per day with all of their stuff and bringing gifts. They brought gifts, special gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, remember? And so they left their countries to find the Magi, the Savior. And so it was very important to understand all of these things relative to the Christmas star. And the Christmas star is central to all of this. So anyway, that's another side topic, and possibly be doing a little bit more on that in the next weeks leading up to Christmas. But also, I will be talking a lot comparing this comet to Hale-Bopp. Now, a comet of this size, one might think, might have a companion. So, the question is, and then this was a big issue with comet Hale-Bopp, that it in fact did have a companion. NASA covered it up publicly, accusing Art Bell of being responsible for the alleged suicide death of the people at Heaven's Gate, when in fact it was a mass murder. And I've talked about this before in the show, and 27, 37 people, I forget, but anyway, I'm not going to concentrate on that. I've done a presentation on that in my Hale-Bopp Planet X Harrington Expedition. It's the 20th anniversary DVD of Hale-Bopp, and it's on my webpage. It's something that's very detailed, showing how the Naval Observatory, Robert Harrington, had discovered Hale-Bopp in 1991 and kept it hush-hush because it was on, at that time, a direct collision course with Earth, direct collision, meaning within a million miles. And so at any rate, that's a whole story, very complicated, not going to repeat it here. I suggest you go listen to that, where all of that information, and I did a number of interviews, those are all contained there. Okay, so back to this will be my main science topic, so I'm going to come back to this topic. But first, a number of topics very important in the world today. And by the way, my current paidcast topic is space travel past, present, and beyond. And so if you're not a member of the paidcast, please join that. It's $3.95 a month. It's the November topic, and it'll run into December. And the Colburn, the science of the Colburn, I've already gotten, I think, four sessions of that done, and I will be doing more of those in the future. That's that particular topic is really complicated, so I have to spend some extremely long periods of time producing that science of the Colburn series. And like the Cosmos series, which I've completed, and that's in the historical record of the paidcast. So at any rate, if you haven't joined the paidcast, go to my webpage. It's all there. And just a quick note, too, because last week I ran overtime and they actually cut off the end of my show. I don't want to lose this at the end of the show, trying to get it in at the end, but the water filter sale is on. It's 10% plus an extra 5% off on major water filter products on my webpage, plus free shipping to the 48 states. And then the Wing email, this is for preliminary customers for a Wing generator. If you are interested in being a customer, then for upcoming installations, then email is jmcc@jmcanniscience.com. And that spelling and everything is on my webpage, so go there, get the correct spelling. Send an email using the subject Wing, and you'll get a questionnaire, and we'll examine your location where you want to put this to see if, in fact, it's a good location. We've been to some locations which some work and some don't, and so we have to examine that. And then categorize the most promising sites for the early installations that are coming up here. That's for Wing generators or electric generation on or off grid. So at any rate, and also just to let people know that for a time I had open licensing. There are no open licenses for development at this point or in the future. So everything has been consolidated, and the Wing generator is going to be, the marketing is starting right now. So to get that initial interest letter in, send the email to jmcc@jmcanniscience.com. The spelling is on my webpage, and then we'll get back to you with further information. Okay, so those three things, the water filter sale, the paid cast, and the Wing, all at the top of my webpage, jmccsci.com. Okay, so I wanted to get that in the middle of the show so I wasn't running off the end of the show trying to quick get that in. Catalan, Spain. This is a huge issue where they have voted for independence. There was a 90% vote, and Spain is a mess. It has been a political and economic mess for a long time. And so these people just wanted out, and they wanted self-governance, they wanted independence. And I get a kick out of CNN, the Candy Nugget News, the Clinton News Network, whatever you want to call it. It's the CIA News Network is what it really is. And the CIA bought it with their drug money back in the early 90s after the first Gulf War. And it's been a total disinformation rag since then. But they're saying, oh, this is no big deal. You know, this is not what it's meant to cracked up to be. No, this area of Spain has voted for independence. And it's even stronger than Brexit. or Brexit, the English leaving the British leaving the European Common Union. And, you know, so that's the New World Order is losing on all fronts, big time. And so anyway, just to mention, this is a huge issue. I want to mention also the election results of the other night, Virginia and New Jersey, two of the biggest cheating states for Democrats that we discovered in the in my study that I did, the math study, the math regressive and mathematical analysis study of the 2016 presidential election. New Jersey and Virginia were not the biggest vote number states, but certainly ranked up there in terms of cheating in the election. And so to see that they had Democrats win in those two states is not a big surprise to me. Not a big surprise at all that they somehow pulled out a couple wins there on seats that are really not important, let's put it that way. One, I think the governor or something. But yeah, things that are not of great importance. But also indicating that there's a war on going on behind the scenes. And they're scrambling. The Democrats have become the New World Order thumping party. Thumping meaning that they're beating the drum of the New World Order, and they've been totally corrupted. And that's not to say that the Republicans are much better. But the other thing that's happening is that the Republican incumbents are not making a strong showing because they're not really, you have to understand, Trump is not a Republican either. And for whatever it's worth, he became a Republican, which was a wise political move, because third-party candidates don't do well. But the corruption in the Democratic Party is starting to unfold with people like Donna Brazile coming out and saying what happened in the background, that, yeah, Hillary Clinton was favored. Favored is probably a mild word, but it was rigged so Hillary would win the Democratic nomination. And quite frankly, if Bernie Sanders would have gotten the Democratic nomination, the election, the way it went out, the way it played out, he might be president today. So she cheated him out of the Democratic nomination and then lost the election. Even with massive cheating of what I had calculated, 17 million votes cheating for the Democratic presidential candidate in 2016. And just remember that the, who was it? There was the League of Voter, you know, I forget what it was, like an organization that does vote counting and checking and et cetera, came out with a figure of 25 million. And people were all over the board on this. Other people followed this, like Alex Jones followed it. He followed mainly the illegal alien votes in estimating 8 million. But I remember that I had like 11 categories, including local cheating, just at the local level, where they would double the count for Hillary and reduce the count for Trump. At the local level, we saw this in Milwaukee, and it was in all three states where they did recounts, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. The cheating was rampant, and we know that the cheating in Chicago was rampant, because Chicago is, I mean, it makes Gotham City look like, you know, a princess at a Sunday church social. You know, Chicago is just immensely corrupt. Although I did visit there recently, and it was a wonderful, clean place to visit downtown. But yeah, the corruption there is just over the top. Okay, so anyway, just a note on that. But very important that Spain became independent, this area of Catalan. And it's a very unique area, of course, has a coastline and a rich history going back thousands of years to understand who these people are and where they came from. But the remember that the Spain in general was cut off from the rest of the Europe by the Pyrenees Mountains. And so they developed quite independently, and it was a Moorish culture. The Moors, which were very advanced in mathematics and in astronomy and astrology, etc., and culture and music and architecture. So Catalan was, you know, one of the rich areas of Spain going back, you know, thousands of years, having certainly a rich independence attitude in their history. So here we are, 2017, with them going independent with a 90% vote. Now, that's interesting also, because in any vote like this, especially where they're dumping the bankers, there's a high level of cheating. And how they managed to pull off this and get the actual count. Now, this is what I was saying about the presidential election in the U.S., that if there was a real count on the election in 2016, it could have gone as high as 90% for Donald Trump and 10% for Hillary Clinton. But with the massive cheating that went on and the scuttling of votes and things like that, but it was interesting to see that Trump knew how, and his staff, even though they say they were quite disorganized in terms of a standard campaign, that they knew where to go and what to do to get the Electoral College vote. And the Electoral College was designed to stop ballot box stuffing, because they, in the infinite wisdom of the founding fathers of the United States, they realized that the cheating that could go on, well, like with the big cities, New York and other places, and that the little guy would be simply left out in the cold all the time. And so they didn't want that, so they built the Electoral College to prevent one region from stuffing the ballot box. And so that's what we saw. There were 10 major ballot box stuffing areas. New York City, I list that in my study, Chicago being one of them, with Hillary picking up 1.4 million votes in Chicago alone, cheating votes, I mean, not real votes. And Los Angeles area, Washington, Seattle, Washington area. And anyway, there were 10 major sites. And what happened also is that these sites carried the state. So if you took and then did an average and you brought down, you just took all that cheating out of there, the Hillary Clinton would not have won any states at all. There were, like, say, Las Vegas was Democrat in by a high percentage and carried the entire state of Nevada, which was 90% Trump. But Las Vegas, the city, carried, that's just an example. Denver was so askew with Democratic cheating that they actually took it off the records. You cannot find the voting records for the 2016 election. You cannot find the voting records for Denver, Colorado. And there again, Denver carried the entire state of Colorado, where the entire state of Colorado was like 90% Trump. And Denver carried the state to be Democratic, you know, for the Democratic Electoral College votes. So if you took away the cheating, the Electoral College vote would have been much, much farther askew or in favor of Trump. And so this is just showing the U.S. sentiment to, or sediment, the filtering down of things to bottom level, let's put it that way. But the election would have been one of the most serious landslide victories in history. But my point is that in Catalan, when they were voting the Catalonia, the vote was 90% for independence. And so they couldn't, the New World Order couldn't even get in there and cheat. And so I suspect that they had paper voting. And it's very difficult to cheat with guards standing there, and one person comes in, gets one piece of paper, goes in, puts down his vote. It's put in a box. Both parties are sitting there as the boxes are opened up to count, and that is the way voting should proceed. But in the United States, you got the voting machines that are run by the people that own the Democratic Party. And, you know, so the paper ballots, I suspect they use strictly paper ballots with a strict counting mechanism where there was no possibility of cheating. And therefore, you see the real count. We see cheating in like the recent election in Ecuador, for example, vast cheating, and the incumbent party winning by a significant margin, but it would have been closer to 90 or 95% to 5% if there was not the cheating involved. And the CIA is very much integrally involved in the cheating in these foreign elections. They have been forever. That's their job. Their job is to keep the New World Order bankers in power. That's what they do. And that includes in the good old U.S. of A. Just a quick note here. NASA is emerging now. They want, remember that maybe a year ago, they had this guy, this little tier two science guy come out with a skinny little tie and announced that NASA would be the Planet X expert from now on. So if you wanted to know about Planet X, NASA was your source. And so I just about fell off my chair after Phil the ding-dong plate saying that Planet X could not exist, nothing like this. And even though that NASA was discovering hundreds of new planets with errant orbits all over the place, NASA finally coming out and saying they were going to be the Planet X experts. So anyway, in the last couple weeks, NASA is coming out with their little group of tier two ding-dong scientists saying that they're going to be the alien experts. So that if you want to know anything about aliens, NASA is going to be your source. Now, I'm not going to waste showtime. I have to laugh because it's so absurd. These people are so ridiculous. These issues, which the public is very tuned to, and by the way, there's always been a tremendous amount of disinformation, and going all the way back to, let's say, Carl Sagan, when he was on the Johnny Carson show. I mean, goes way back when Johnny Carson was before Jay Leno on the Tonight Show. Johnny Carson was the original Tonight Show, and he had Carl Sagan on. And he had another guy named Whitley Strieber, somebody that I've been on radio shows with, Whitley, going back in the mid-90s, the original Art Bell show. Whitley was a co-guest with Art a lot of times. And I was on as a guest with Whitley, with Art, back in the 90s, talking about the Hale-Bopp issues and a little bit about the alien issues and stuff. And, of course, Whitley was a famous, famous author. And had his place up in upstate New York, where he started having alien experiences. And he would wake up in the middle of the night, and this would happen to him in his room, like in the house, and he didn't know what was going on, so he went public with it and wrote a book about it. I've got the book. I don't have it in front of me, but just look up Whitley Strieber. You will find it. But he was on Whitley was on the Johnny Carson show with Carl Sagan. Now, I remember this distinctly, and Carl Sagan going, "I don't have time for such nonsense," you know, the Carl Sagan, super arrogant, all-knowing, you know, like David Duncan, chair of astronomy at Cornell University. What he says, you know, he has a direct link with God, and everybody should believe him because he's Carl Sagan. And poo-pooing Whitley Strieber. And Whitley Strieber was not claiming to have seen aliens. He's saying something is going on here. It's a worldwide phenomenon, and people have had these experiences. whether they're, you know, encounters of the first, second, or third kind, or whatever, or, you know, appearances in their room, or whatever. And Whitley Strieber was simply saying we need to investigate this as a real phenomenon. And, of course, Carl Sagan, assuming that Whitley is talking about alien contact with people, and poo-pooing him, making fun of him on national TV. Now, 2017, NASA's going to be your local alien expert. If you want to know anything about aliens, you know, NASA's going to be your man. Or actually, in this case, I'm sorry, woman, because they got this ding-dong woman on there. Not that there are some good women scientists, but excuse me, there's some of these, the women just as bad as men in Tier 2 science that just don't have a clue. I was at American Geophysical Union one time, and this woman had just been hired by Goddard. And she was elderly. She had gone back to school, a lot of respect for that, and got her PhD in, I believe, astrophysics, which is no small thing. It's no small order to do that. And her first job, and she was probably 50. I estimate her age, you know, maybe 50 years old. And she had raised her family, gone back to school, got her PhD, and then got a job at Goddard. And she was with the Comet guys there, Carrie Liss and, you know, the boys from Goddard, and Tom Cravens, and from University, I think he's at University of Nebraska, but these were the guys touting the X-ray and Comet stuff. But she was a new member of that team. And they were setting up their table next to mine at the American Geophysical Union meeting. Out in the auditorium, everybody has a table, and you set up your documentation and information so people come by and talk to you. So they're at the table right next to me. And, of course, I'm touting my work of the X-rays with comets and the plasma discharge comet model, and none of the rest of those guys would talk to me. Tom Cravens was mildly sociable. He was an okay guy, you know, in terms of normal personhood. But this woman was totally green, so she didn't know who I was or anything else. Those guys did, and were not allowed to talk to me. But anyway, so she comes over and says, "Hi, how are you doing?" You know, and she looks at my badge, my American Geophysical Union badge, and it says "Independent Scientists." And she said, "What's an independent scientist?" And I said, "That means I fund my own research, I do my own work, I don't work for the government." And she said, "How could you possibly do research without being associated with the government?" She couldn't fathom the idea that somebody could be a scientist and not work for somebody like Goddard or NASA or a university or have an affiliation. They could not fathom such a concept. So anyway, this is what I'm saying. These are people that have learned standard science. They've learned all the standard theories. They think they're smart. They don't know anything. And especially they don't know that there's an entire layer of science above them of which they know nothing, and that the science that they're presenting is Tier 2 fairy tale science, and they're experts in it. And so anyway, now we have a genre of scientists. The one they were presenting was a woman. That's fine. But all I'm saying is that they fit right in with the men. So they can put on their, their badge and stand right next to the men who dominated. Let's face it, men dominated science. You'd go to the American Geophysical Union meeting, 20,000 scientists, maybe a total of 50 women there, scientists, out of the 20,000. So let's face it, that's just historically the way it's been. And they're trying to turn that around and get to so there were more women scientists. And I did see a lot of very sharp, very intelligent young women coming in to these from various different countries, Azerbaijan and Russia and other countries, who are producing serious, you know, intelligent scientists who have not been educated in the Western way of Tier 2 fairy tale science. But, of course, as soon as they get them here, They want to protect them and keep them away from people like me who would be teaching them something else. Let's just put it that way, the true nature of science and the scam that is NASA. Boy, they don't want those young scientists, men or women, talking to someone like me. In fact, that I think I've mentioned this before on a show. I was at an American Geophysical Union meeting once, and this was probably in 1997, as I recall. I have a poster, the same poster that I had there. And this top-ranking NASA official came over, and he started talking to me, and he was very angry, very angry with me that I would present non-standard science on my presentation. And I didn't quite notice, and then I looked back, and there were about 30 graduate-level students and young scientists standing behind him, probably about 30 feet away, watching him talk to me. And I thought, wow, this guy is teaching his students that are young, upcoming PhD postdocs that I'm an outlaw, you know, and they basically teaching them, don't talk to me. They were not allowed to come near me or talk to me. And he was trying to harass me and get me out of there. Michael Muma, who has been instrumental in suppressing my work at Goddard and JPL, etc., but and also stealing it at the same time. The X-ray and comets work that I did, the work on Mars oceans, another thing he happened to lift off of my own webpage and then try and promote it, of course, giving it the NASA spin. But just another incident like this. I was at an American Geophysical Union meeting. This one was down in, I think this was one of the Florida ones, but a young, brand new PhD student from Azerbaijan, a woman, and very intelligent. And they were doing work on minor planets, actually putting them back together like a jigsaw puzzle using spectroscopy, which was a very interesting, very intelligent woman. And her sponsor, who came over and saw her talking to me and came over and was extremely angry and just basically railroaded her away from talking to me. But this is what goes on within the open scientific community. They don't want these people to even hear about me. I could go on with stories like this all day. But anyway, the point, go back to the original point, NASA's coming out, and they want to be your alien experts. If you want to know about aliens, listen to NASA, even though for decades they have poo-pooed the idea of Planet X, aliens, etc. But they want to control the narrative. Interesting note came out in CNN. I go to CNN to learn what the standard news media is trying to disinformation, trying to pound out there. This is interesting. The United States is the only major country not to have signed on to the Paris Climate Change Accord. Now, that's a good thing. And so the rest of these countries are fumbling around out there. And remember that the United States funds all of this. So all of the big money was coming from the United States. And, of course, Obama was big, 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 big on this. And Hillary Clinton would have been big, big, big on this. But Trump, knowing that this was a giant scam, signed out of it and said, no, we don't want nothing to do with it. And pulled all the scientists back, which is good. There's no climate change. We've never had stable climate ever on this planet. Maybe back to the dinosaurs, there was stable climate for a period of time. But in any recent history accountability, Earth has not had a stable climate. So how can you talk about climate change, and especially trying to relate it to man-made issues when the sun is variable, all of the other issues going on. But it's not due to you driving your SUV up and down the road. The the heat coming off your car engine is millions of times more than the stupid greenhouse effect, which doesn't work. So, you know, it just was a big ruse right from the very beginning. That's all it ever was. It was a way, and the scientists, of course, would jump on the bandwagon because they got a big career out of it, salary. And that's just true of scientists today. You know, if you want them to say climate change, they'll say climate change. Give them more money. That's what it's all about. The squirrels learning or forgetting how to forage in the forest as scientists. They just, whatever the government source of money is, that's what they'll say to get the money. Just a quick note on car mileage. I keep seeing this, people going, oh, the carburetor, we could build a carburetor that'll get 100 miles to the gallon or 200 or something, some ridiculous number. Well, let me explain something. The engines that are being built today are extremely efficient, but they're being put in cars that are aerodynamically inefficient. So it doesn't matter. There's a limit. There's simply a limit. There's a certain amount of energy that it takes to push that car down the road. And so say you had a 100% efficient engine or whatever, it's going to take a certain amount of energy to push that car down the road because of air resistance. And the fact that they build a little flat back end on these cars, they're not tapered, they're not aerodynamic, in which it's basically creating a vacuum, especially when you get up to, 60, 70, 80 miles an hour highway speeds. And the way you can tell this is your gas mileage goes down from, let's take an average modern car, 30 miles to the gallon on the highway. If you're going 60 miles an hour, let's say that you get 30 miles to the gallon. These are hypothetical numbers, but very close to a lot of modern cars. If you go 70 miles an hour, you're going to be getting 26 or 25 miles to the gallon. If you go up to 80, you're down to 23 miles per gallon. And that's because you're pushing wind. It's you have to move the air out of the way. And at the higher velocities, the wind resistance goes up as the square of the velocity. So that's what you're doing. You're simply pushing air out of the way. Now, if you took and built an extremely aerodynamic car with a thin leading edge and long sweep, and then that's where the passenger compartment would be, and then a long trailing edge leading out the back, with that same motor that you have in your current car, you could probably get 80, 90 miles per gallon easily. So what we're dealing with here is poorly designed automobiles, very simply. They're not aerodynamic. They're not aerodynamic on purpose. And then they promote this myth that some guy invented a better carburetor that you could get 80 miles to the gallon. It's simply not true, because you have to push this car through the atmosphere. And I did a lot of traveling recently and was doing some experimentation with mileage, etc. And if you go up to, say a 5,000-foot altitude on a plane, on a flat surface, and say at sea level you're getting 30 miles to the gallon at 60 miles an hour. At a 5,000-foot altitude, you're getting 36 to 38 miles per gallon because the atmosphere is one half as dense, very simply. So it has almost nothing to do with the motor, certainly not much to do with the carburation, everything to do with the aerodynamic nature of the automobile and simply air density and factors like that. So if you want to improve mileage, you have to build a car that's aerodynamic. That means thin leading edge, thin, and more importantly, a thin trailing edge. And look at all the cars on the highway today. They have a little scoop coming off the back, which creates what? A vacuum back there. So that vacuum is pulling you backwards. The cars today are not aerodynamically built. They're built to cost gasoline. And so, and then they don't talk about that. What they talk about is carburation and you know, putting all kinds of things on the engine for pollution control, etc. But it all comes down to body design. Simple, pure, and simple. There is news going around that there are indictments in Washington, including Tony Podesta. This was the campaign manager for the Hillary Clinton campaign. And the word is that these are related to pedophilia. So anyway, all I want to say is that look at other sources for this. And I don't have myself, I don't have information on this myself, other than I would encourage people to follow these stories because they're very big. This is the Achilles heel of the New World Order. And so it's something, it's a way of taking them down without going directly at the beast. Anyway, something you do want to keep an eye on. Just a note on Puerto Rico. I was a guest yesterday on the Power Hour with Daniel Brigman. And of course, my Wednesday regular interview show, second hour with John Moore, the Liberty Man. And on both of those, I brought up the idea that Puerto Rico, the people are leaving in droves. And that was the plan all along with Hurricane Maria. Remember, I told you that Maria was a manipulated storm, just like Irma, and it was designed to destroy Puerto Rico and to basically eliminate the population so that the big international corporations could come in and basically build mega hotels, mega condos, and remember that all of the records would be destroyed there, the land ownership records. So basically they're going to come in and say, oh, gee, there's no records here of you owning anything, and steal that island, which is historically, geographically, one of the most prominent places in on the planet, basically steal it, and for the New World Order, so they could come in. And that's just a loose term for the bankers, the Jesuit bankers from the Vatican. But that's what's going on. And then they're going to say, they're going to pull out the, oh, now we can control hurricanes, so there won't ever be a hurricane there again, and encourage people to come and buy this high-end real estate that they're going to develop there. You just watch this. And so it's a same thing that happened with New Orleans, where they gutted the place of poor people. So anyway, worth mentioning, worth following that story, because there's approximately, I think the population recently of Puerto Rico, 3.5 million people. That's a lot of people on that small island, and mainly concentrated in the San Juan northeastern region. And then I think Ponce, the southern major city on the southern side of the island, where the vast majority of those people lived. But certainly an island with a lot of social problems, a lot of crime, etc., a lot of economic problems, but being thoroughly robbed of their heritage, of their livelihood, etc. So that just by a manipulated storm named Maria. Is that coincidence, or is that coincidence, or is that planned social engineering? Okay, so I'm going to jump on to the main science topic tonight. And by the way, this is why I have my paid cast, because there's so many topics that I have to cover on this show that are related to science, weather, social engineering, economics that are related to science. You know, the manipulation of a hurricane to destroy an island for economics and who's doing it. Things that you're not going to hear literally anyplace else on the planet. So that leaves me with less time for true science on this show. That's why I have the paid cast, to go into the deep dive into scientific topics. So, and for $3.95 a month, that's a pretty good price for the amount of information you're getting there. And by the way, there are half price upsales on all of the things, like all the shows going back to August 2016. My ebook library that you can get for half price when you join as a paid cast member, etc. So at any rate, okay, so talking about Comet C2017 K2. This is my main science topic for the for tonight. And so here we have a planetary object in formation. This is exactly what I was talking about last week. And as I said, I did not announce this previously because I didn't trust any of the information that was available. But I'm going to pull up an article here that was put out. This comes from Science Daily, which, of course, is all of these are, disinformation sites that are controlled for your science disinformation. Top headlines, etc. They post themselves as being the top science outlet. And this article, let me get the date on this. This is from September 28, 2017. Source NASA. Summary that NASA's Hubble Space Telescope photographed the farthest inbound active comet ever seen between Saturn and Uranus. And then they go into this. Listen to this. This is in the summary. It says, slightly warmed by remote sun, it has already begun to develop an 80,000-mile-wide fuzzy cloud of dust called a coma, enveloping a tiny solid nucleus of frozen gas and dust. Then they go on to explain that this is the farthest comet ever discovered. But they have to, right out of the chute, get that solid nucleus of frozen gas and dust. Well, did they observe this? No, they're simply saying it. This is not a scientific fact or even measurement or anything. It's simply the standard story that they have to pump out. But now let's examine the real information that we can glean from this. 80,000-mile coma. Okay, so that is bigger than, or I should say almost as big as the planet Jupiter. Now this is the coma. Okay, so then they go on to say that the nucleus they have measured or determined, and they're stating this as fact, which I'll explain the disinformation involved here. They're saying that it's a 12-mile-across nucleus. Well, let me explain something. Out there in that region of the solar system, a 12-mile-across object is, the sun looks like a dim flash. It looks like a small star at that distance, or it looks like a little bit bigger than average star at that distance, and there's certainly no energy coming that would evaporate or sublimate any type of volatiles that we know. So they go into this long tirade that there must be other volatiles from the original formation of the solar system, and that it came from the Oort cloud, which is supposedly this cloud of comets out way beyond the solar system, which nobody can ever measure, nobody ever has measured. But let's look at this so-called determination of a nucleus being 12 miles across. How do they get this? And of course, they don't tell you, so I'm going to tell you what they do. They take a reading of the nucleus, which means they have had information to get light source data on the nucleus. And what they do is they measure the amount of light coming off the nucleus. So they make a measurement. Then they assume that the nucleus is pure white. In other words, an albedo of one. That it reflects all of the light that comes to it. So in other words, a pure white snowball. And so then they say, okay, well, that amount of light would indicate a nucleus of 12 miles in diameter. But here's the problem. We've been to, many, many comets. I don't know if it's up to a dozen now. But we've had satellites go by comets, including Halley's Comet, etc. And the comet nucleus is black, blacker than the blackest coal that you can imagine, the blackest material object in the solar system. So now, let's see. The reflectivity of black is almost zero. It's not an albedo of one, it's an albedo of near zero. In other words, it's not reflecting hardly any light. So your light reading coming from something that's pure black must be much bigger. In fact, bigger by thousands of times the surface area that's facing Earth. So that means that this object could be as big as Earth. It could be much bigger. It could be, you know, something, well, much bigger than Earth. So, but they lie. They lie using totally incorrect assumptions, a measurement that is iffy by best. And then at the end of the article, they talk about, well, in the future, they'll have other techniques like heat techniques, measuring the heat coming off the nucleus to determine its size. But fast forward to radio telescope, the use of radio telescope signals. They can tell using radio telescopes how big this object is because it doesn't depend on the temperature. They can send out a signal and then watch for the reflection of the signal to come back, and therefore tell the size of the nucleus. It's another way of measuring the nucleus. And they have done this, but they're not talking about it. And so you can see that the Tier 2 scientists are doing bad science and then reporting it in this article. So let me just go through some more points about this particular, this so-called announcement. It says that this K2017 K2 Pan-STARRS, or K2 as we will call it in the future, has been traveling for millions of years from its home in the frigid outer regions of the solar system. And they talk about it being very cold, 440 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, once again, that's something from a textbook. That's not a measurement. And remember when they said Pluto should be this cold, icy body, and they get out there and it's got bubbling surface, it's got an atmosphere, it's got a comet tail, it's snowing in the atmosphere, and they don't really know what to do or what to say about this. And so then they have this guy, researcher David Jewett, University of California, Los Angeles. Here's your Tier 2 scientist, here's your spokesperson for the disinformation. And it says, he suggests, oh, isn't that nice? Here's our expert Tier 2 scientist. He suggests that sunlight is heating frozen volatile gases such as oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide, and carbon monoxide that coat the ice comet's frigid surface. No, it's discharging the solar capacitor. Just like Pluto, just like other objects out there in the far reaches of the solar system. Okay, clearly this is a topic that I'll be talking about in future shows. I'm out of time for tonight. Remember the webpage, jmccsci.com. The 10% plus extra 5% sale on all the water filter products. The paid cast, $3.95 per month. The ongoing series, Space Travel, Past, Present, and Beyond. And then also, if you're interested in the wing, send the email. All that information on my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.